Our Beer Could Be Your Life is brought to you by... My lords, my ladies, my non-binary gentry, you know me as a just and honorable man. So today, I, Dennis, Baron of Barleywine, Marquis of Martzen, Duke of Dunkel, and Lord of Packaging, do humbly swear my fealty to House Lager for this night and all nights to come. Pledge your fealty and drink House Lager by Jack's Abbey Brewing, Framingham, Massachusetts. Loyal to lager. This week on Our Beer Could Be Your Life, Matt and Joe sit down with Andrew Falkus of McCluskey, Future of the Left, and Christian Fitness. They had a really cool conversation about all things, you know, post-hardcore and whatever that means. We actually did a intro, the three of us, but I'm doing a solo intro today because we had some technical difficulties. So, yeah. And fair warning, there is a pretty liberal use of the C word in this episode, if that's a issue for you. He is an Englishman, so he's got an accent where it doesn't sound quite as abrasive, but that's up to you to decide. All right, so enjoy Andrew Falkus.
Good, how are you?
I'm okay. Do you want me to get some headphones, or does that work okay for you?
If you have them, our engineer would love it.
I have. The problem is, you see, I have obviously a studio set up upstairs and also a fucking cat trying to get through a cat flap as we speak. But for which I have an ensemble of headphones, but to unplug them all takes a fucking blue age.
I'm trying I will to say think. This.
This is a MacBook, a new MacBook.
Yeah, I think your audio sounds pretty good.
It sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that as a result of it being a new MacBook, obviously without the right fucking dongle, it's about as useful for,
you might as well just get a tin ear.
Good for you, I can.
But I think you sound pretty good.
I did a thing with my friend, John, who plays in a band called John. And he wanted to do it on, I fucking forget what it was, WhatsApp or something. No, it was Instagram video. And it wasn't until we started doing it live that you discovered you can only do it actually on your phone.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of doing that is just ridiculous anyway. Doing it on your phone because you can when you have a perfectly serviceable MacBook or whatever or laptop. And the first 20 minutes of the interview, which was going out live, was me trying to get the phone to work. You know, it was one of those one of those hilarious moments, which we will hopefully forget about. I think only about 60 people watched it. So
perfect.
So who cares? It was like playing a show. It was like playing a show in Detroit, except 60 people were there.
Yeah. I saw you tweeting about, potential future returns to the US, and I'm sure you get people hitting you up, like come to our city. And what is up with Detroit? I would feel like Detroit has the right constitution for what you're bringing to them.
No.
You,
well, constitution aside, you know, no, just a fucking shocker. It was the first time we did Detroit as McCluskey. I don't remember the name of the venue. It wasn't very big, but there were about four people there, and the promoter left before we played because the White Stripes were playing a homecoming show. And you get that. That's a big local thing. This is like 2002 or three. They were particularly big then, but I can't help wounding even the most balanced person when the promoter goes, well, have a good show, I'm off. You're like, ah, fantastic, great. There's another band that I prefer playing down the road, so I won't be watching you, but by all means, perform and feel important. And the second time was in the Magic Stick, which is was a bowling alley, like stroke venue. And when my back isn't making my life pure hell, I love a bit of a bowl. Jack and I from the band, we used to go bowling like three times a week, like a long time ago. So he's fucking great though. I'm decent, but he's great. And we played the Magic Stick and there were 18 people there in a room which probably holds about 400. And it was one of those shows where you end up talking to everyone in the crowd because otherwise it's super awkward. You need to meet a lack of attendance head on. You do, if you pretend otherwise. And every single person there had come from Canada. There wasn't one Detroit person there.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. So that's Detroit for me in a fuck show. You
know? Well, yeah. Fuck Detroit. We're from Boston.
Well, no, I don't need to fuck it. You know, I don't need to fuck
You don't have to call it either.
I just also, need
like, how many times did that guy see the White Stripes? Because you come to the States how often?
Well,
fuck that shit.
Well, maybe he was playing the long game. It was 2002. He wasn't to know that we were about to come this epoch defining. I can't even say that. with a straight face, but yeah, it was one of those moments. Maybe the night before would have been a show which, if you'd taken it too seriously, could have given you a big head. So yeah, I have a beer in the freezer at the minute, waiting to become
perfect.
Irrelevant. It's just when I say a beer, it's just in a, like an Estrella thing. But I've been pretty ill over the last year in different ways. And so my alcohol intake, which had begun to reduce anyway, is reduced even further subsequently, which is a good thing, I suppose. But I was physically unable to drink because of medication for about 7 months. And yeah, that was pretty tough. Yeah. And it turns out that alcohol is far less of an inhibitor than things like OxyContin or Cocodamol, or that shit is nasty. It really, again, puts things like a little bit of weed in its proper perspective. But
seriously,
I don't react very well to medication like that, it turns out. I get all the side effects and none of the effects. So I get all the drowsiness. I, you know, would faint. I get palpitations, but I wouldn't get any pain relief, which is pretty shitty fucking trade-off. But, you know, but this is my coping face. So,
yeah. Look at you cope. We appreciate you. I am
coping like fuck, mate. Yeah, we moved quite recently to Bristol because we lived in London for a few years because my wife wanted to buy a place. With us being officially old, it felt like the time to stop renting as you approach 50. So I say we own a house. The bank owns a house.
Sure. You own probably that door behind you and maybe the door frame.
That door and the other door behind it. But it is it is nice to feel as if you're at least pretending to invest in something before it all gets taken away from you. So how long have you guys been doing this podcast for then?
Well, I think the idea of this started before pandemic, and Mr. Otsilius here had it as people would visit Boston on tour to stop by our brewery, sit down and have a beer with us. And, you know, it would be be a fun and easy time on the way into the city, as our brewery is about 15 miles outside the city. We only started doing it during the pandemic because we were bored. And we're like, right. Wait, everyone else is home alone. We can talk to people and we can boost people's profiles the best we can and talk about beer with people who give a shit about it. And actually a fair amount of people who don't give a shit about beer, who used to give lots of shits about beer and now don't drink at all.
I still definitely drink. I mean, joy to me at the end of the day is, well, not even at the end of the day. I've never really been a day drinker because I like to sleep at night. But just a lager, especially a lager after a workout. I know it's not exactly the way it's meant to go, but you know,
that's a shower beer, right?
It's man. I was in college. I used to drink bottles of Thunderbird wine in the shower. I used to go for about a 12-mile run. And then, because I've always been a runner, I love running, which is one of the reasons my body is now basically a fuck yard. I used to get in the shower and drink a bottle of Thunderbird. Because in my hall as a residence, it was a room with just a tiny little shower. And then basically, or a bottle of sherry if I was on a budget, you know, and then just collapse out of the shower and go straight out. Because I couldn't afford to really drink in the student bar. So maybe pop a tab or two of acid and then, you know, go and have some totally normal conversations with people who couldn't wait. I don't know what the experience of going to college is like in the States. The first year of college in Britain, or university as we call it, is basically people just telling each other what they got for their A-levels, which I guess is the same as your SATs.
SATs, right.
Yeah.
Is that same in America? People just go around telling people their SAT scores? Is that?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I dropped out of college, so I'm sure I didn't say it enough. So
no, that was your problem right there.
That's for sure. That's one of the issues right there. I didn't preach enough about my SAT scores. Probably what kept me going. Yeah.
Because I had really good A-levels, but it didn't really tally with what people were hearing because of where I was from as well. Even though I didn't have a particularly strong accent, it didn't really register with a lot of people who hadn't quite got into Oxford or Cambridge, which is, as you probably know, is kind of our gold standard of a wanky education.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, a lot of shower drinking back in the day, but it's been a long time since I did shower drinking.
You know, a shower lager is probably different than a bottle of Thunderbird in the shower. I just think.
Yeah.
But I do agree with Oz here in that, like, there is some level of electrolytes to beer and rewarding yourself with them after a workout, I think it's a very fine thing to do.
Oh yeah.
Bum wine aside, there is a fantastic website I recommend called bumwine.com.
Bum wine.
And it has very in-depth reviews of our bum wine of choice. And I probably shouldn't say bum wine, but we're speaking of a specific brand here.
We're amongst friends here. We understand the context of your hateful speech.
Mm-hmm. So MD 2020 was the local swill of choice, which we refer to as Mad Dog.
We again, this is, you know, American culture pervades everywhere. We had Mad Dog 2020.
Yeah, you're welcome for that, and rock and roll and everything else that definitely white people like us invented, right?
You're giving America credit for rock and roll now?
Sure.
I thought that was Panama. What the fuck?
Mm. Well, the canal helped it. It's
all, yeah, the canal, loads,
all science.
That's how I also think it's the song Panama by Van Halen that really... Right. Is what rock and roll started.
Oh, absolutely. Could I think of a more enjoyable enjoyable song on such an enjoyable record?
Why didn't you write the song Panama by Van Halen? Why did Van Halen?
Let's get into the real questions here.
Yeah.
I can't answer that question. My bullshit motor hasn't reached.
Understood.
On bullshit level, you know, sometimes I can fully engage, but you asked me that question and my brain just went, no information, none.
Well, no. All right. I have a better, more well-formed question, as we are here in more or less Boston environs, home of Mission of Burma. You have typified, that's how I escaped my certain fate as a hallmark of pop craft in some sense. Yeah. So, why didn't you write that song? No, because you're probably old enough to write that song.
Well, I've tried.
Yeah. You have written songs that remind you me of
creative
that.
Ways. The band I came quite late to, Mission of Burma, I remember actually doing, I don't know what McCluskey record it was, but being there and in Chicago doing the record in Electrical Audio, which is Steve Albini's studio, and Bob Weston, who, and again, I wasn't overly familiar with Shellac at the time. I knew of Shellac. I'd heard the record, 1,000 Hertz, but they weren't. I kind of came from a more mainstream kind of music in my early part of my life. Like, and so I've kind of gone the opposite way to most people, gone further into the underground as opposed to, you know, inching more towards the mainstream in general, in terms of my tastes. And Bob played a little bit of, cause he'd, on, was the, which yeah. is like on back yeah. one. I remember my first thought of it was I liked it, but didn't particularly engage with it at first, but I could tell it was an older band purely because of the drum fills. The drum fills have that kind of, what's the guy called from Wire? Is it Robert Go to Bed? You know, it's kind of that way of, the drum fills have that way of saying, and here's the next section of the song, for fuck's sake, you know, there's no, and I'll,
I know what you're talking about, because the way I think of that is like the drummer is waving a flag to the rest of the band because he just hits all of the toms in a row.
Yeah. And it's very much a like a Sonic the Hedgehog drum fill, as in we're going this way, we finished, and now we're back at the beat, you know, as opposed to like, well, let's face it, a lot of rock drumming, unless it's really set in the underground, is very much post Grohl and Nevermind, isn't it? And In Utero, it's got all those big fills. It's very difficult to not invoke him in terms of drumming. Let's keep it just to the drumming, though. And then subsequently, then listening to On Off On and loving it, and then going back to like discover the earlier stuff, and then actually doing a show with them in Bristol, where we happen to live now, in the Fleece, which is a venue we play quite a bit now, and they didn't have as big a crowd as say we would have, which is farcical, you know. But there was such love. I mean, they're all lovely, but Peter Prescott is particularly lovely and forthcoming, and we did like an All Tomorrow's Parties with them. And I wouldn't say they're friends exactly, because I don't know them well enough, you know, to say they're friends, but they're certainly lovely people. And when you meet people who are in bands, and it sounds a bit po-faced to say this, but for the right reasons, just for the love of rock and roll, and they're some of those people, you know, when you meet people like that, it doesn't even need to be explained or analyzed. It just emanates from every pore. They don't need to, you know, they don't need to justify why they're there. They're smiling, they're guys, they get up, they play, they finish, and all the rock and roll has happened on the stage. You know, they haven't kept anything back for a potential fingering or whatever, you know. Yeah, really, really lovely people. And that song is just, I don't know, it gives me a rush every time. There's something about it which is very youthful, but not in a way which insists upon itself, you know? It just goes. And at first it sounds disjointed. I love stuff which sounds a little disjointed, and then it just clicks in the last 40 seconds. The things you're doing make sense.
Yeah, it's like so economical. And what it gives you just enough of that adrenaline rush and that hit of the, like the sugar of this, like that melody and that the build up towards the end, but you don't get so much that it overstays its welcome. And it's just like, I don't know, it's abrasive while also being warm at the same time, in a way that, I don't know. I think a lot of your music also I mean, not specific to that song, but you have a similar like balance of like abrasiveness and warm, and like seeing where the pop craft is and where the where the angularity exists as well.
Well, it's easy to, well, it's not that it's easy, but it's certainly easier to do one or the other. I think to do them both at the same time is a bit of a challenge. And it's a challenge that, frankly, I can look back on albums and songs and say it's worked much better at certain times than other times, and or by song by song, you know, the balance works better for this song or less well for this song. I mean, most of Mission of Burma stuff is far more angular than that, you would say. But I love that stuff just as much. But there's something about that song, it just tells you everything you need to know, I suppose. You know, like you said, and it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's
just, certainly not.
And the sound of it as well. It's just, there's some songs are even songs you like, we're talking about Van Halen earlier, but you listen to Van Halen and you just hear the 80s, don't you? In every way, you fucking, it's as much a part of the 80s as the Breakfast Club or some other shit from the 80s, I don't know, tie-dye or whatever. But a song like That's How I Escaped My Certain Fate could have been, as much as I was dating some of the drumming earlier, the song could have been recorded yesterday.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it belongs to a particular era. It just, it's this like beautiful layered pop song that like that tape effect puts you on edge while it's going on too, which is amazing. But
what else is really good about Mission of Burma is, because sometimes it's good. I know music's good for me because I won't hear the word. If something's really good, I generally don't think about all the working parts. It just happens and you don't end up thinking, are the way, unless you, you know, specifically sat down to analyze it, you don't think about the way things work together. So, for example, when I started listening to Mission of Burma, I didn't even know what Bob did in the band for the later stuff. You know, I'm not saying that it wasn't important, but the sound had a magic to it, which didn't require necessarily analysis. It just, that's how it sounded. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's part of the thing which makes it so unique. A fantastic band.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, Burma, effectively they're a trio. I mean, I know Bob's over there doing tape loops, but I think, you know, if you think about the way that they have that dissonance and stuff, I think a lot of the stuff you do, I was listening to a lot of Future of the Left the last few days, because I mean, I love that band. I saw you guys back in 2009 when you played TT's here in Boston. And
I'd say RIP TT the Bears now.
RIP TT's, yeah. It sucks.
I mean, it was not the best venue, to be fair.
No, but it was a venue. Like, and we're
sounded losing. Like a tin can. But
it was a venue where I think we were, a lot of people at least showed up to see you. So
yeah, no, but I had some great, you know, great times and a lot of fun there. Was that one in 2009? Was that with that band, the Datsuns, headlining? But
you guys were headlining.
Oh, right.
Yep. Okay. And I only know that because my friend's band opened.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because they like begged the TT's booker to like put them on at the start of that show to play with you. And I was just jealous because I was like, why didn't I do that? I could have groveled and got on that bill, but.
there's a lot of that in band time. I mean, it doesn't happen so much with McCluskey because that's just got a bigger profile for all of the reasons. But with Future of the Left, we get in the first week of putting some show. This isn't the case anymore. It does a lot better than it used to. But it used to be the case, particularly in certain cities, we'd get as many people really wanting the support as we'd sell tickets. You know, sometimes we'd go, especially in places like Newcastle, where I'm from Newcastle, but we don't do particularly well there. And we'd maybe sell 11 tickets in the first week and there'd be like seriously 9 bands desperate to support. You're like, well,
you buy a ticket.
But if you could turn into the show, that would be just fucking splendid. You know, you can't take that kind of stuff personally though, because we're quite the opposite. It's still an amazing honor. It's just not a monetizable honor.
You know,
I think what we're learning is that your fans are poor and can't afford concert tickets, but they do really love you. So.
Definitely.
It's one of those things. Got a few friends who play in more proggy things, you know, where, you know, real, where the fans are real gear nerds and everything, and they'll pay fucking 45 quid for a vinyl, and, you know, and they want to, and they want effect. Like, I mean, we did an effects pedal for our last record and it did okay, but some people I know in bands, they'll make tons. But basically speaking, the people who come to see us, representing, frankly, the people who are in the band pretty accurately, are pretty hard up. And I take it as a, and I try, I hope you kind of respect that as well. Don't take the piss out of people. You know, it's a thing sometimes needs to cost some money in order to be made, and things definitely aren't getting any cheaper, but you're never going to get a bit of vinyl coming out with five different covers from us and encouraging people to buy the different versions. I'd rather, you don't need to be some DIY fanatic in order to find that kind of shit embarrassing. I think, you know, incidentally, that's one of my pet hates in 2021, bands describing themselves as DIY bands. It's like, I assume you do it yourself, you know, we pretty much all fucking do and have done for a while. So what else have you got? You know, like, you know,
yeah.
I think it's got a slightly different, it implies more of a community in the States than it does here. Usually if somebody says, usually a band who describe themselves as DIY over here would be the first cunts to snatch someone's hand off at the first, because it's a performative statement, you know. It's like in some circles, telling people you're a feminist is informative and useful. In other circles, it just makes you deeply suspicious, doesn't it? It's like, what are you fucking hiding? You know, and everything. People talk about things being performative, but everything's performative. It's called communication. So
yeah,
we end up in the same, we're talking about this with somebody earlier about, you can take some identical statements from people on issue-based statements. And what you end up feeling about that statement is to do with the context of the speaker, you know. Like, I can say, for example, don't worry, this isn't going anywhere dodgy. I can say, I believe in immigration controls. And what I mean by that is, we shouldn't let in rapists and murderers. You know, that's what I mean. Whereas somebody can use exactly the same words and mean, I don't like brown people.
To be happening in both of our countries, but
not
great. I feel like a lot of our countrymen over here feel like we just fixed something that's wrong. Like, oh, great, done. I don't know, we're there yet.
From a relatively outside perspective, the battle in America seems to be, from on one side, voter suppression, and on the other side, a rapidly changing demographic.
Yes.
So, but you can't really, unless it comes to, voter suppression's always been there in different ways, whether in Britain or America, most of them subtle, you know, moving boundaries, like I know happens a lot in the States. But you can't see how, there can't be a way that demographic change doesn't outpace that kind of institutional intransigence. I can't imagine that not being the case. Although, of course, there's the assumption that non-white people will end up inclining left, which isn't necessarily the case, as the rest of the world shows us.
Yeah. Know? Now, we learned that in our last election too, and people were, I think that the left was really counting the votes of Latinx people in this country as, oh, we've got them. Don't worry about it. Like in Florida,
for example.
Right. Yeah. So it was a lot closer than it needed to be, we'll say.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole world was watching, definitely. And it was very worrying. I mean, I was going through my own personal hell at the time, so I was unable to sleep, but I pretty much, you know, I injected all of that injection coverage into my face in a way that I normally wouldn't, because I don't like to, yeah. I don't need to encourage anxiety. You know, it tends to happen of its own accord, anyway, but it was quite startling. And I don't think anybody's got an answer to all that shit, do they? Otherwise they'd have put it into action by now. But I mean, it's the same here. I mean, again, Boris Johnson could rape a dog in Parliament and 44% of the electorate would go, well, it was a foreign dog. Or
is he what the dog was wearing?
Or the dog appeared to enjoy it, or, you know, well, it wasn't my dog.
The dog was asking for it.
The dog was asking for it. Dachshund blaming, perhaps. it's a very sad state of affairs. I have a lot of, even though I've never really spent time in Boston, I've spent time in Cambridge, playing TT the Bears, but I have two pretty good, what I call good friends from Boston. So I speak a lot to them using the wonders of the internet. My friend Matt, who lives up in Winthrop, I think it's called.
Yep.
And a guy who's an author you might have read, by a guy called Paul Tremblay. Do you know? His most well-known book is called A Head Full of Ghosts, which was like I don't know if this is a dismissive way to put it, it's kind of a modern take on the Exorcist kind of thing. A couple of those, it shouldn't be this as a benchmark of quality, but I know a couple of his books are being made into films and
things. Cool.
Lovely guy, very encouraging with all the writing and stuff. I met him because he contacted me because they were using one of a Future of the Left lyric for what's it called? I always forget what it's called, an epigram, which is the, you know, when you've got like quotes at the start of books, you know, to give them some resonant meaning. So it was using like a bit of a lyric, which was from a song called An Idiot's Idea of Ireland. And he wanted to use this lyric, and we've kind of been friends ever since. But I'm really desperate to play in Boston for all the reasons, but that would be really nice to play in for friends to see you play.
Well, we'll be there. So, you know,
Very much trying to sort out that tour at the minute. It kind of, a lot in terms of doing in Northeast, maybe over to the Midwest tour, a lot of that kind of hangs on the kind of show and the kind of fees we can get in New York. And then if that works out, then you can try and sort it, but it's so expensive to do. I mean, for visas alone, you're looking at several thousand dollars. If you play in, say, Australia, you get a visa which is particular to the time you're there. So you get if you're there for 10 days, you get a 10-day work visa, whereas for the States, you have to go through a very complicated process and you pay for a whole year. My last US visa cost $3,500.
Jesus.
That was a 3-year visa, but so you're $10,000 down by the time you stepped on the plane. Now I don't have that kind of money spare. Well, I don't have that kind of money.
No, you definitely can't afford a tape loop guy then to come to America.
No, you're gonna stick with the power trio situation. You may have to do it yourself. You may have to sell your merch.
He could be on Skype. Yeah, but it is really desperately trying to see if it can work out. And frankly, the last time we played the States, we did a tour in 2012. The Boston show was cancelled because of whatever the fuck hurricane it was.
Oh, sure. Right. We get those.
That was, I think that was Sandy.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Oh, and that didn't even end up...
That didn't even do any damage to us.
Didn't do anything.
Yeah, well, hey, what can I say? We were...
That was the one after Irene, and Irene was 2011.
Right.
Irene destroyed my house. It's the only reason I remember the day.
You would remember that.
Well, that's a good reason to remember it. But if we can't do US dates around the 20th anniversary do Dallas, then we can't do US states. It's as simple as that. What happened is it was always a law but it started to be enforced around 2010-11. There's a 30% withholding tax that venues have to withhold from bands at source. So say even if your fee is $2,000, your fee on the night is $1,400.
Hmm.
And that instantly made touring impossible for us. As you would imagine, if somebody's suddenly going, and we're taking 30%. Because bear in mind, if you're touring with an agent, then that amount's already 15% less. So any fee you've got, you're 45% down on straight away. I'm trying to see if it's possible. And also Damien, who plays with us now, he's never toured the States. And just in terms of having a friend who'd like to do a nice thing, hesitate to say it's on his bucket list, because that seems like a, you know, it's just not a term I get on with, but it would be lovely to actually do it. And also to see a friend enjoy it as well. You know,
I was just thinking and talking to Matt this week about this, how I actually realized now that going to a Mission to Burma show with a friend who afterwards realized I would like McCluskey and Future of the Left, I was presented that music at the same time. So I listened to McCluskey do Dallas. I started listening to Future of the Left. And to my mind, I guess I'm more engaged with Future of the Left than McCluskey. And I find there to be just like, there's more of it. It's, you know, progressive. And I guess I just realized that you're dealing with people who are hounding after you for the McCluskey record because of where it dropped in their life and where it, what it means to them.
Because of the time that happened is because of the what it means to them as a result, because the music which means the most to you is the music you probably find between, I don't know, 17 and 21, those formative experiences, whether it's college, whether it's you tied to a friendship group, whether it's tied to a relationship, it really is. It goes beyond, I think, just a base nostalgia. Oh, remember the 80s? Yeah, we fucking remember the 80s, you can. But it's just like that moment where everything clicked, I suppose. And so we do now increasingly get people who find Future of the Left, then go backwards to McCluskey and maybe find it a little basic in comparison, you know, which is totally understandable. Do Dallas definitely has a coherence to it, not a planned coherence. It has a thing about it and everything about it. There's not like a, I mean, click application form is a bit of a pain in the ass, but it has like, there's really not a second wasted on that record. But the problem is when you've done that, unless you want to be popular in Germany, you can't just repeat that forever, you know? You can't just moat ahead it and do a distorted bass line. I sing some bullshit over it, and then I play a little melody, and then another verse. Again, we can't all be Sleaford Mods and just use the same. I like Sleaford Mods, but it's...
You have to get to that, because I feel like there's a working man conversation when it comes to music right now, coming over here from your island, and there's a conversation that I think parallels beer as a working man's beverage. But I do want to ask you before we go there, what the band that fits that for you, or the record that fits that for you when you were 17 to 21, where it brings you to that place?
I don't know. You see, I think it is that there probably are those records, but for me, it was more the records I got late, which I think define the records I like. And I particularly think about not even a band I particularly like because of new metal. I mean, they should probably be crucified crucified every day through eternity. But Angel Dust by Faith No More, when I first heard it, I thought it was unlistenable garbage. and In Utero, when I first heard In Utero, when I was 16 or whatever, 17 when it came out, maybe. Again, it wasn't never mine, so I wasn't interested in it. Whereas 3 years later, they were my two favorite records. So, I mean, I'd say In Utero is held on probably in the top 10, 15, whereas Angel Dust has probably fallen a little bit.
It still has some jams on it, though.
Oh, no,
it really...
I'm not saying it's anything less than a fantastic record.
It does sound like when it came out. when we were talking about that earlier. It's definitely when it came out.
It is.
It definitely spawned some horrendous fans.
Well, I think the real thing spawned some horrendous bands. I think
that's fair.
The
fair.
I'd say Angel Dust gave them a second and third album. You know.
Yeah.
I think I ended up being defined a little bit by those records. But for me, particularly loved the Pixies. Though, again, I haven't listened to the Pixies probably for 20 years because it was like growing up, I've never once owned or had to put on a Beatles song because the Beatles were on constantly. There's no, you know, I know every Beatles song without ever having chosen to listen to them. And it got like that to a degree with Pixies. I really loved the Pixies, but I just became again that guy who I never really thought I could make music. And then I went to the Reading Festival, hilariously termed the Reading Festival by the worst American bands. You know, whenever you know an American band is bad, or no effects, which means the same thing, but when you'll find them on stage. And you're waiting for it. Me and my brother used to play the game, which American band will do the Reading Festival joke? Because it's just fucking so, it is, you know, it's what you call entry level humor, isn't it? It's literally the first joke which occurs. And if the first joke which occurs, you should think about why it's occurring to you so fucking quickly, you know? It's always the same. So, and there's always a little self-satisfied. What are you guys reading at the Reading Festival? And there's always some 14-year-olds at the front going, oh, that's brilliant, because those words are nearly the same. But everyone else is like, oh, last year it was Pennywise did that. Now it's you, cunts, isn't it? come on, roll up, fucking who? Oh, it's Billy Mahoney this time. No, what that fucking band called?
Billy Talent? That's an English band.
They're Canadian.
New York.
They're Canadian.
Got it. Yeah. We have a Reading here in Massachusetts, which probably masked some folks who would have made that joke, but just wouldn't, you know, they would have gotten it already.
They would have
gotten it out of their system earlier in life.
Their system really early. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a thing. But yeah, I went to the Reading Festival a few times. I liked playing music, but I didn't think I had a particular strength for it. And also I was never a particularly confident person. Like the idea of standing on stage would just be ridiculous. Like what is that about? But I saw so many bad fucking bands, like really bad bands, and just going through the motions as well. And as somebody who'd, you know, read a bit, but didn't even consider myself bookish, I was increasingly meeting, when I was 17 or 18, people, intelligent people in bands who would just kind of feed everything that is in their life through this rock like paradigm and just all sing about the same things and in the same ways. And everything was just the same. Like, is this song about girls or society? Like, flip a coin. Like, Which one is it, you know? And how, and the nuance was just, I don't know, like seeing, I suppose, what fucking people were getting away with. It was like, I can do that loads better than that. And I have no physical confidence whatsoever. So
you were like the heckler when the comedian finally says, well, why don't you get up here and do it? And you're like, I will. And you just destroyed it.
In a sense, but I would never heckle. Like, wow. Like, imagine being the heckler guy. I just, wow. My Julia, who plays in Future of the Left, my wife, she worked for as a long time as a comedy booker and with a guy called Stephen Grant over here. He's not famous, but he runs a couple of comedy clubs. And so been to see a lot of comedy in my time, but being a heckler guy, oh my word, I don't mean not saying an occasional funny thing. That's cool. Interaction, especially at a rock show. I mean, we kind of thrive on it, but an actual heckler who just goes and keeps going. I mean, as much as we thrive in it, we've definitely had shows spoiled by somebody who won't shut the fuck up.
Yeah, and we have to point somewhat to alcohol and substances that results in people yelling Freebird over and over again, expecting that joke to sometime land for you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, now I know, I can remember very clearly one show in Sydney in like maybe 2008, where there was a guy down the front who'd met Jack before at a previous show. And he was right down the front. He was shouting stuff out all the way through. And it was funny at first. It went through the different stages of pathos and bathos and back to pathos again. But you need to remember sometimes when you're on stage, if you've got somebody at the front shouting at you, people at the back of the room can hear what you're saying, but they can't really hear what the person at the front is saying. And now basically, this is a checklist in my head. You get four maybe, and then after that you get your money back and you get to fuck off. That's how it goes, you know. But part of like the back and forth with the crowd is what makes shows special. But me a heckler, no sir, no.
There's a legendary bootleg compilation of Ian MacKay's crowd work over the years, right. You know, and the famous $5 envelopes that they just like, here you go, get the fuck out of here.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's hours long of him just, I mean, I don't know. I think earlier in his career, he would have fought back, but he just like, I think just stealing it through hardcore and then being whatever Fugazi he became, like just having the ability to just give it right back. And, you know, he was very, very sharp to it.
You've got to be careful. I'm just going to get a beer. One thing I will say is, have you seen the Todd Barry crowd work thing?
No.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Wonderful. It's really magical. Hang on.
I'll get one too. Are you drinking one, Oz?
Yeah, I have.
Jenny?
No, I grabbed a zero gravity pills. You know, I had to have drink a lager, so.
Just a cheeky Estrella there.
Looks good. I think Joe bought some.
Well, this is an Estrella Dam. Now, it's one of those. I just wanted to say about talking about the crowd work stuff. You've got to be really careful, in my experience, not to become too defined by it. Because at one stage with our bands, we became a little bit defined by it, and as a result, you get people. And it's okay to come along and want to contribute to the show, but you get people coming along thinking it's like a thing to take a shot at you or whatever. And that's really tedious for everybody else in the crowd. Cause it's not, you end up saying, I know you think this show is about you, but it's not about you, you know, or you end up saying things, something like, what happened to you, man? You know, what brought you here? You know, what sadness in your life turned you into this? Although with some more creative swearing in.
I would
hugely recommend that Todd Barry one. The crowd work one is great. I mean, all his stuff is pretty great, but there's something others, particularly, you can even find out on YouTube, there's a particular interaction with some guys who are in a band in that, which is just wow. I mean, you couldn't script these people, you know. It's quite fucking marvelous. So yeah, Estrella Dam.
Estrella Dam, let's talk it.
Right. So apparently, and I could be wrong here, a lot of people, and I've been told this by two incredibly tedious people, right? So if it's wrong, I blame them. I know one of the guys was called Colin. I can't remember the name of the other guy. They were very guys though. Yeah, a different Colin to that. But apparently Estrella is not the brand. The brand is Dam, and Estrella means the best beer of Dam. So Estrella Galicia again. But Estrella Galicia is really, really, really lovely and smooth. This stuff's okay, but it's. So Estrella is the like the number one beer. I don't know if they actively market their number two beer, you know. And this is an entry level beer for people who, you know, taste isn't so important. You don't mind if you get some stomach problems. So that would be the
We have previously discussed the worldwide marketing campaign of one Carlsberg brewery, which in the US is still probably the best beer in the world.
Probably, yeah. Carlsberg would have been a big, I mean, obviously I haven't been inside a pub for a year and a bit, and I'm not the biggest pub guy anyway. I'm one of those people who genuinely prefers to drink by myself. Not to huge extents. I'm a couple of drinks kind of guy on a very regular basis, but getting drunk just doesn't work for me.
I feel like, the same way. Yeah. I'm the same. I like having like two or three beers and going nice.
Two or three beers. I like the second I start to slur a word is the second that, or if I'm really tired, or back in the day if I'd had a bit of a smoke, I say you know a lot. That's my, I suppose, my it's my thinking phrase. In the way Australians say, look. They go, look. You ask them a question, especially Australian sportsmen, they go, look. And what look means is I'm fucking thinking about how to answer that. So look. Oh, fuck. Okay. Look. Though sometimes they'll say it three times, but that's definitely my tell. But yeah, Carlsberg, wow, that's a bad drink. Our rider says no Carling, because Carling's more pervasive over here. Sure. No Carling, Carlsberg, or what's the other fucking one? Foster's.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
You mean Australian for beer? I'm sure your wife's very familiar.
And underneath it'll say manufactured in Nottingham. And you're like, you're brewed in Nottingham. You're like, yeah, fucking... Like nobody I've met in Australia, or Julia's Australian, we go to Australia a lot. I've never seen anybody drink Foster's. like nobody fucking touches it. And again, Carling is a great beer if your idea for a night out is to spend it all having a piss, you know, because about 3.5%. I mean, for a lager to be functional, you need it to be at least 4%, don't you? Otherwise...
I think so. I think that's a functional.
Yeah, you know. And I really don't trust when people say, hey, this is a great session IPA. You're like, session IPA? Do we need to be so clinical? Can't you just have things that you like? You know? Can't you just have things that you like?
We need boxes over here right now in craft beer where everything needs to have a little home. And
it's the same as music. Everything has to be lumped into a subgenre of something and just thrown in. It's just...
Yeah, post-pre-hardcore. Like people call it noise rock, and I'm like, sure. Post-hardcore, sure. You know, whatever works for you. Loud rock music.
I think that's fine.
Yeah, it is. It's fine. I mean, I know it, you know, it doesn't work as well on a Spotify playlist, but I think it probably should.
All things post-hardcore here.
Yeah, post-hardcore. When people are like noise rock, you're like... You know, you could say the Jesus Lizard were noise rockers. No, noise rock implies to me the music is more defined by its chaos and its rhythmic and its noise than its melody, you know? So I would say the Jesus Lizard were a noise rock band, and I would say we aren't, you know? Even though we have elements of that, you know, but we're defined by the melodies first and foremost. Yeah, beer, wow. I suppose obviously the American equivalent would be Bud Light or whatever, or Coors, but
there are many, many tiers of American macro beer. And we, you know, there's definitely a bottom. And I don't think you're really at the bottom when you're talking Bud, Miller, Coors. Those are regular.
What's the worst?
Those are middle of the road right there.
Where's PBR? Where's that? Low, middle, what?
You know, PBR has this outsized impact in music in this country. They've been really keen to promote music and be involved in festivals. And from a quality perspective, I think it's below those personally. But I think it's a standby. And anybody who tells you they don't, like when you're scanning the lineup at a House of Blues in Boston, like you're probably going to end up trusting the PBR more than you are a draft beer.
Because you know what you're going to get with it. And as long as it's fucking suitably cold.
Right.
Cold and cheap.
Yeah, cold and cheap. I mean, because cold is, let's face it, drinking it cold is part of the fucking lager experience, isn't it? It's to, I don't know, returning to the womb if you were raised in Norway. But PBR, I definitely haven't hated that. What an endorsement. I know it's hardly an American beer, but we played Spaceland once in Los Angeles, and they offered us some drinks on the ride, and I was like, oh, these are all terrible. And she went, what about Red Stripe? I'm like, I don't think at this time I'd had Red Stripe before. Ended up having it again. Red Stripe is definitely a lager where if you have it cold, you're like, this is okay. I don't mind this alcohol delivery system. It's fine. But if it's anything less than very cold, it's fucking nasty
stuff. Yeah, if you can taste it, there's a problem.
Yes. Precisely. When we were really hard up, when we started the band, so probably late 90s, we used to drink really strong cider, or a thing we've got called Tennent's Super, which is like 9%. And we used to have throat lozenges to deaden our throat to the taste.
So fantastic.
You just drink it and you would, we're scum, British people. We are scum. Like, you know, there's no other way of looking at it. But you just basically take away the taste because it's the only way you can drink strong. Have you ever had super strong cider?
I have. I don't find it particularly pleasant. Personally,
no, you don't. Have you ever had it's always the rock and roll, or we're crazy drink of choice, I've forgotten what it's called. It's a Scottish drink. It's caffeinated wine. It's called Buckfast.
Yes.
Oh yes, I have had Buckfast.
It's made by monks.
Yeah, when I went to Scotland 2 years ago and definitely got some Buckfast at some bar where I was just like, give me the weirdest thing that you guys make.
That was yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. They've probably got a lot weirder than that in Scotland. If you're that cold all the time, mate, you fucking do weird as well. It's great. I mean, it's one of the best places for us. No doubt about it. Every fourth person is ginger. It's really fantastic, but again, I'm from the northeast of England, so just south of there, but having lived mostly in the south for most of my life, I've totally acclimatized to being down here now. So when I go up there now, I'm fucking freezing, but I have full respect for people who can live up there. With Julia being Australian, I mean, she regards London and Bristol as being cold. So there's no way we could ever live. But Glasgow is an amazing place. It's really, I'm assuming you went to Glasgow then?
Did you? I actually went to Edinburgh. We were going to go to Glasgow and we just like found so much stuff to do. We didn't rent a car or anything. So would have taken a train and we just ended up finding stuff to do for the entire
Edinburgh is a more beautiful city, definitely. And it's got much more to do culturally in the direct, if we go for the original meaning of that word. Glasgow is more of a nightlife city. Definitely, and better for shows and things like that. But Edinburgh is better for looking at things, certainly. I don't think Glasgow has a castle unless that's a euphemism for some very nasty sexual stuff, you know.
I didn't get to find out.
No.
You didn't ask for a castle in Glasgow?
I didn't ask for a castle. Well, when I asked for it in Edinburgh, they just pointed to that giant castle.
To the castle.
Where else did you go in the UK then?
That was it. We went there for me and the wife's first date was at a Scottish restaurant. So we took our honeymoon to Edinburgh.
Scottish restaurant? I have no idea there was any such thing as a Scottish.
There sure is.
There is. There's a, you know, a Scot living in Jamaica Plain here in Boston, and he opened a restaurant strictly around his entire culture. And it is fantastic. It is the best burger in the city. And I stand by that.
Okay. So it's haggis and stuff then?
Oh, yeah. They got haggis. I mean, it was the first time I think I had a Scotch egg. I don't know how Scottish a Scotch egg is, but I had it there.
I don't know if it's particularly Scottish. I do know that it's a crime against all that claims to be food. I mean, I've been for dietary reasons, it started with me with a lot of allergies. I'm a vegetarian now, but I was never a big red meat eater. It was pretty much chickens. Pretty much hide when I came in the room. That was the thing, lest I care them limb from limb. But I never went as far as haggis. I just I would always struggle with specific body parts. Like, by all means, give me chicken, but there would always be something queasy to me when somebody say, oh, chicken breast. I'd go, oh, now I can visualize the part of the animal that I'm eating, you know? Whereas you can remove yourself from the equation if it's just a part of an animal. I go, oh, it's probably a part it didn't need, you know?
Just gave it up.
Probably left that behind.
Yeah, he left it behind somewhere. So now
he was moving to a new coop and left that behind. And now I'm going to eat it.
So now I'm just having a nice meal. Yeah. But yeah, no. Yeah, I started, this doesn't interest anybody, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
Yeah.
I got a really bad egg allergy, which started 2 years ago, just from fucking nowhere. It's particularly mayonnaise stuff, like projectile vomiting and everything. It's fucking rubbish. Just happened. Age of 44. Oh, by the way, welcome. You've suddenly got an egg allergy. I'm like, you're fucking joking. Because my favorite food is curry, but beyond that, it would be a pizza of indeterminate quality with an egg on it. Yeah. It's just, I mean, just how it works, like the texture of it is just basically you fry the egg on the pizza. That's
sure.
It. It's a big, that's actually a big thing in Australia, but I'm not following those weird cuts. It's incredible. I absolutely love it. But yeah, I can't eat it anymore. And the band laugh at me because, you know, when you go for food now, when you're touring, they ask you about allergies and you've got to say, I have an egg allergy, but as long as the eggs are properly cooked, it's not mayonnaise, then it's probably okay. And you can see when I'm saying it, they're all behind me going, there he is with his fucking egg allergy again. You're like, listen, it's not a performative egg allergy. You've seen me projectile vomiting, you know. So
I don't know. Performative egg allergy sounds like a song title of some kind.
Well, it's probably a Butthole Surfers album, isn't it? Let's face it. So yeah, we're not a very rock and roll people. We had something I remember very clearly is we were in Seattle having a pizza, me and Jack. I think this was Future of the Left. And he went, oh, do you remember that pizza we had in Melbourne with the broccoli on it, like whole bits of broccoli? I went, yeah, yeah. I said, you know why I remember that? He went, why? I said, because when we were sitting there eating the pizza in Melbourne, we were talking about a pizza we'd had in Seattle. So we'd just, you know, we were talking about previous, it was a big circle of feeling pathetic but proud at the same time, because that's just how it goes as a band, you know. It's awful because sex, drugs and rock and roll are fine. I'm a proponent of all three at various times, but food's better than all of those things.
But pizza, I mean,
yeah,
it's just pizza, great. Over haggis.
Curry, mate. It's curry. Indian food. It's all about the Indian food. Like, and I would, yeah. I always look forward to having Mexican food when I go to the States. Mexican food.
air quotes are required for that.
But I'm not sure, being a vegetarian, I'm not sure how well it works.
Works really well.
Still works, does it? Yeah. Okay, all right.
I was vegetarian for many years, and actually Taco Bell is a reliable source of, because they assemble it all for you. You know, it's DIY.
Yeah.
they do it for you in that situation. But you can put it all together in nice ways.
Right. Yeah. So I love, a bit of spice. Not so much that you don't want to be a spice hero. You know, you don't want to be rolling around with your mouth on fire going, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. But I like that little bit of a burn, you know, and you just start to sweat, but you just start to sweat. You don't, I've definitely asked for a couple of extra hot gel phrases or vindaloos and ended up having to go to the bathroom and towel myself down. You know, that's not necessarily, it's not necessarily how the food experience should go.
One of our friends and a previous podcast guest, Jeff Rowe, makes delicious hot sauces. And one of his hot sauces is a curried sriracha sauce, which I put on pizza last night, which really, that really spoke.
Well, our friend Ian, who has played for the last 4 or 5 years in Future of the Left, he plays in Art Brut, That's the band that he does mostly. He puts fucking sriracha on everything, like absolutely everything. It's, I mean, because, you know, obviously I'm a bit partial to a bit of that, but sometimes you have to slap it out of his hand. You're like, you are absolutely not putting that. You know, you are not putting that on that, you know. No, you can't put it in red wine. No, stop it.
Oh,
it's like your kid trying to put ketchup on everything. You're just like, just taste the food.
Try it before we douse it in ketchup, you little shit. Yeah.
No, I'm related to people who do that. And my sister, not to call her out, loves ketchup, puts it on everything and doesn't like tomatoes. I'm like, you just like sugar. That's it.
Yeah, you like sugar. Yeah. There was a guy I worked with years ago called Ryan, and when I started working with him, he had the worst girlfriend. I mean, some people divide opinion, but some people don't divide opinion. It's like that Bill Hicks line about pro-life people, you know. There's some disagreement in my social circle. Some of them think they're annoying idiots, and some people think they're evil fucks, you know. She was pretty much the same, and she was like, we were out in the pub one night and she went, oh, I hate foreign food. You know, okay, well, we're British, so that's food then, you know. As much as America is a melting pot, Britain, you know, up until 1066 was just a compendium of invasions. Okay, all right. I hate cheese, she said. You're like, can you hate cheese? I mean, hating cheese, I mean, you may as well fucking, if I found out I was, intolerant to cheese or whatever, I'd just jump off a fucking bridge. My life would be over. And I hate tomato. And you can probably see what's coming. What's your favorite food? Pizza. Right. I think you've made an error by coming here tonight and continuing to breathe, you daft bitch. You know. what is wrong with you? But anyway, he ended up meeting a lovely woman and they had three kids and now they're divorced. So the story had a happy ending.
Yeah, but it was quite an arc there.
It was like Lord of the Rings, though. It went on too long, didn't it? So
maybe that woman tried an heirloom tomato and came back around.
Yeah,
tomato front.
I've never quite got over that. It's just one of those ridiculously basic things. It's like when you're on tour, the first time you go on tour with, say, an American band, when you're a bit younger, although I didn't, it's a little bit different for me because I didn't go on tour until I was 27, whereas most people who are in bands, they start touring when they're 19 or 20 or something. So, but there'll always be a thing when it's somebody's first tour, where if there's a British band and an American band, where they'll have a discussion about who has the better sports. Yeah?
Sure.
Like, as if it wasn't part of some long-term conditioning and stuff that you just happen to grow up with, you know? The things I like are better because I like them, is what it comes down to, you know? And that's fine. It's like lots of things in this world. It's just fine to prefer things. You don't need to justify them, but no, it's better because I hate it, you know, when people do that thing where they put the finger on your lips.
On your lips. Yeah, we're not doing
yeah,
that
yeah, yeah no
that's death by pandemic, and I'm cool with it.
Yeah, well, especially now, there's a guy who used to do sound for us, a guy called Dan, who looks like a baby. He was young, but he looks like a baby, so we used to call him Sound Child or Sound Baby. Great guy, didn't move his arms when he was walking, though, so a bit disconcerting. You'd be like, what is wrong with your have you not updated your software or something? His arm. But he used to do that, like you'd be joking, he'd go, shit, put his finger on your lips, and like, seriously, if you do that again something very bad is gonna happen to you, you know, like I'm gonna
bite that finger.
That has got to be a British thing, because that has never happened to me.
I've seen a few people do it. I'm not, it's obviously from a show or something, because I've seen enough people do it, but yeah. I don't know which show it is. Let's call it, let's not call it anything.
Yeah, we don't need to.
Let's totally forget.
Unpack that. We can just.
I've actually had that much beer for the first time in a while, so I'm actually even tipsy. So.
All right, let's go. I intimated earlier. You mentioned Sleaford Mods. I have listened to and enjoyed Sleaford Mods. I also don't know if I like Sleaford Mods, even having listened to them plenty. But I understand that there's a tension. I don't understand. Like I went and saw the Idols a couple years ago when they toured the United States, and they played a fucking weird bowling alley in Albany. There's this like, you know, we talked about performative feminism and performative working class hero kind of vibes. And my understanding was that Sleaford Mods basically called them out for it, and that there was a bunch of back and forth in this scene about who's really real in this. And, you know, me, I'm a rock and roll fan. So I was like, well, hey,
I have to declare an interest in the sense that Dev, who's the bass player of Idols, is a good friend of mine. And they're a Bristol band. They're local to you. They were based in Bristol. Although I've only lived here for 2 months, so I'm hardly a local, because I spent 24 years of my life in Cardiff.
I called you Welsh, or I intimated you were Welsh. Yeah.
Well, people always say, I mean, McCluskey were a Welsh band. We started in Cardiff. We were, to all intents and purposes, Welsh. Although when McCluskey started, John, the bass player, John Chappell, he was from Cardiff itself. Though Cardiff isn't a very Welsh place. The only thing which would make you know that it wasn't a English city was there's bilingual, like road signs and things.
Sure.
Whereas other parts of Welsh are definitively more Welsh. Matt Harden was from the valleys, a place called Llantrisant. But neither of them had a particularly Welsh identity. You couldn't tell they were Welsh on meeting them, really. But people would say the band were Welsh because we were from Cardiff, and you just go, yeah. I mean, I think there's a, for want of a better term, you understand, when I say liberal, I mean liberal as in somebody vaguely on the left. In Britain, we were very ambivalent, people on the left certainly, about our national identities, probably too much so, to be quite honest with you. But we'd be mortified to be seen to be flag waving. Now, I think people say that's the same in the States, but you guys definitely have a stronger national identity than we do. Even people who purport to not have it. I can see that when the USA gets criticized, liberal people still kind of, they hold the line, but you can, I mean, you guys, the national anthem every day, in school, that kind of thing?
Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance. I've never sung our national anthem in school, like nothing like that. And again, religion just isn't a thing here. If you were, you know, trying to get elected on the basis of being very religious, good luck to you. That's not to say it's an idol, far from it, as somebody like Boris Johnson would show. You can appeal to things like racism, just don't say your racism is because of a magical figure in the sky. I think the authenticity or otherwise of those bands is really interesting. Like, it's really interesting the way it's sold and the way it's kind of accepted to a degree at face value. I'm not sure about the, you know, that friction between those bands, but I find the point of difference is really revealing. You know how it's like, I don't know if you find this, in your own life sometimes you've got to be very careful at the things that you get exercised about, say with your friends, or the things you hold your friends to account for. You're not holding them to account because you're scared that you're doing them yourself. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, in the sense that there was a guy I went, this is a very simple way of describing it, but there was a guy I went to college with who was from a place called Exeter, and he was called Dave, so everybody called him Exeter Dave. And he had like this bit of this weird fucking thing about infidelity. I mean, to the point of ridiculousness, you know, like some guy who had a girlfriend would just look across a bar, there'd be another girl, and he'd be like, you should be fucking ashamed of yourself, mate. And it turned out that he'd been cheating on his fiance for like 9 months. It was like that bizarre level of overcompensation.
Sure.
And all I'm saying is sometimes it's important. Sometimes the things we get the most annoyed about, the behavior in other people. Like sometimes I get annoyed with my wife for being lazy, and that's because I'm a lazy person.
Yeah, you like project your like things that you don't like about yourself.
Absolutely. And you hold somebody to the standards you wish you could hold yourself to. So I think sometimes in these debates about what's authentic, what's middle class or working class, what's authentic or not authentic, the person speaking about those things is revealing a little bit about their own psyche as much as they are about the assumed position or psyche or whatever of the target. And it points to an insecurity. And if I was to look at those bands, right, Idols aren't particularly up my street. But I will say for something which gets that big, it's about as good as it gets. Musically, yeah, would that be a fair thing to say? Like, you're not going to get anything any more angular or any more interesting. And sometimes it's politics or social studies 101, but somebody's got to be doing that, you know. And musically it's pretty good. There's nothing wrong. Sleaford Mods, as I rather dismissively said before, you know, it's like a, there's a bit of a bass line. The man says something, says cunt in a weird place rhythmically. And then they say the title of the song. There's a second verse that's half as long as the first. Say the title again. Slight twist and then we're gone. You know, fair enough. But again, I heard some, especially early Sleaford Mods, which I really enjoyed, you know. It definitely invokes a place. I think what is clear is for whatever fucking reason is that there's competition between two wildly successful bands. Right. Who most musicians would fucking kill to fucking... I honestly feel, and again, I haven't even talked to Dev about this, the bass player of Idols, because it just... I honestly feel as if the guy from Sleaford Mods is projecting his own insecurities onto another band. But... again, I could be totally fucking wrong. You know, I don't think these two bands are class. And I just think there are things you can criticize Idols for.
Sure.
I don't think their class or the people they're speaking for, I think you can criticize them for that. I just don't think that's necessarily, I think that's burying the lead a little bit, maybe. You know, you could maybe talk about, you know, deigning to speak for women as a feminist, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, feminism, as far as I understand it, involves not just telling people that you're a feminist, it involves allowing women to be at the front of the conversation, you know? I think
what I found fascinating about that conversation was like the fact that it's revealing of something in where you are and where these bands exist and they come from. But like over here, it's like cool music blogs, like both these artists. And like, so people who are into music are like listening to this stuff. So like, you know, it doesn't really reflect, I think, any real class difference on our end. And, you know, Matt and I work for a company that makes lager, which is a working man beverage that, you know, but we're, you know, a craft brewery doing it, and we're not, you know, we're somewhere in between. So we're also trying to do this thing where we're like, all right, we're going to do this like simple, beautiful, pretty small thing. And then, you know, are we trying to speak to craft beer nerds? Are we trying to speak to people who just are trying to have a pint after work? Like we also exist in this tension between working class and not, I think.
Well, it's
capacity.
I mean, it's shorthand over here, certainly in terms of the music press since time immemorial, Sex Pistols fucking onwards, probably before that, but I refuse to have a cultural memory which precedes that. Working class equals authentic, middle class equals trust fund. Yeah. Now I come from a family where my father was a headmaster, principal. My mother was a teacher. My father died quite young. So culturally, I'm middle class. But financially, we were worse off than all of my friends when I was growing up. So we're at a bizarre fucking intersection. I've obviously got the, and I'm not using these terms lightly here, I've got the privilege of having an educated parents who educated me. So I had educational privilege, if not financial privilege. And I recognize those things, but I find it really amusing because it very much depends on the person I'll speak to, whether they then will regard my voice as being valid. So there's a lot of class washing sometimes in British music in an attempt to make it seem as working class as possible. Whilst at the same time, there's an issue where, frankly, increasingly with in the modern environment, but it, and it's not just restricted to music, it's the arts in general, it's writing, it's acting. You know, you get people like, you know, I suppose people like Benedict Cumberbatch or whatever, all those guys, you know, the very middle class, privately educated. You're talking middle class in the sense of coming from parents earning hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds a year, as opposed to just being the son of a teacher or whatever. And but those people have, I'm assuming it's the same in the States, genuinely have more opportunities in art because they have more time to devote to it.
Right.
So you do have a genuine tension. But my problem is, or rather my perspective is, that if you have to bring out a fucking trumpet and start playing the fanfare of authenticity, then I don't know. You see, that's for me, that's kind of where the thought ends, because it's kind of assessed on a case-by-case basis. We can normally work... You can hear what's authentic to you, or what seems to be authentic. Obviously, that can be undermined through additional information that you then receive. But I don't know. I find it. I think it's okay to say you don't know what to make of a particular conflict or yeah. situation. And I don't know what to make of all of that. I don't have any answers. I have an odd, well, I say odd. It's odd to me because I find it spoils things for me. I sometimes don't enjoy things, especially bands. I have this, it's a non-superpower because I don't have it, but I think I have it. I think I can see people's motives, right? A band on stage, I think I can see why they're there. It's bullshit because I've had that contradicted by when I've then later met people or whatever, you know?
So thanks to your connective powers, I have coming to my house soon a Christian Fitness record by way of Annapolis, Maryland, and the lovely folks at Catronic Records. So thank you for connecting me. Tell me, I think we're like coming to the end of this thing, but I want to know, where does Christian Fitness live and Future of the Left and McCluskey in parentheses? What's the current and future status of these projects for you?
Well, Future of the Left and McCluskey just kind of live in the rooms when those songs are played. And occasionally I'll write a song. Nearly everything I write, I'll try in a room, nearly everything. Unless it's apparent that it just wouldn't work. But yeah, it's just the combination of the people that are whereas Christian Fitness is just the stuff I do fucking on by myself. It tends to be the stuff which has a lower vocal register works better as a Christian Fitness stuff, whereas Future of the Left and McCluskey stuff is dynamic live stuff which works really well in that environment, because if it's not exciting in a rehearsal room, then it's just not going to work. That's about the level of thinking that goes into it. I mean, when I write songs, I do go, I always make notes. I'm like, that's a Future of the Left song and that's a McCluskey song, but it's very rarely gets front. I mean, if something is very straight ahead, it might be more inclined to be a McCluskey song, but that's kind of a really simple way of looking at it. We're working on, we've talked about basically doing a record with McCluskey, partly just because we want to have a nice time together as friends. We'd love to go back to Chicago and record with Steve again. That would be loads of fun.
We want to listen to that.
Well, the thing is, there used to be this thing with doing music in general where it was obviously you're always in the moment when you're performing, but a show or a record, it was always about the other place it could take you to. Whereas now all of these things are done entirely for their own sakes, whether that's a tour or a show or whatever. There's no illusion that it's going to result in a show which is twice as big the next time you come through town. There's no, and in, I was about to say in some ways that's really liberating. That's not true. It's really liberating in the same way that I, having done lots of jobs over the years, mostly as admin in like public housing departments, which is very rewarding but depressing work. You would feel jealous about your friends who are on tour all the time. Envious might be a better word. I don't know, you pick. But I can honestly say with a couple of exceptions that never gone on stage thinking, oh, fucking hell, I've got to play that song again. Because I haven't played those songs too much. And it means that there's never been a show where it feels like just making up the numbers or, oh, fuck, we've got to get through this shit so we can play the big show in New York or whatever tomorrow. And it's really special, and it's always special. In terms of McCluskey, it got pretty tight at times because John, who was in the band for a while, I kind of had to motivate him to go on stage for the last couple of years, and it just doesn't feel special as a result. Whereas now in the band, I mean, Damien was a fan, so he doesn't need to be told that it's special to you. With Future of the Left, I mean, Julia is, if anything, even more committed to the stupid idea of rock music than I am. And Jack is Jack, who's a very lovely, slightly bumbling man who is just an incredible fucking drummer. Such an incredible musician. It astounds me that, aside from the band and the music, which has probably found the audience that it deserves or whatever, it astounds me that he's not a better known musician just for being a musician, because he's incredible. The second he plays the drums, you know it's him.
Yeah, and I feel like you can definitely, when you write a song, you know that he's going to be able to like carry that song with you. Yeah. So like, you don't have to overplay, you get to play exactly the bits you want, and he's going to fill it in perfectly.
Oh, he's an incredible drummer. I mean, most drummers, hilarious drummer jokes aside, most drummers are usually the most musician-y musicians. You know, they're usually the ones who they understand the theory. I did the violin when I was a kid, but I did the thing called the Suzuki method, which is basically just learning by ear. So I don't read music almost as a point of principle. It sounds ridiculous, but I don't like to know what key a song's in unless I absolutely have to. I just start playing. I find that way you're probably going to find your way to something more interesting rather than just going, oh, you're playing the second fret. I too will play the second fret. Sometimes that's what you end up doing. That's what works, but for me that should be the last recourse. But he's an incredible musician, and I mean, Julia's a fantastic musician, Ian's a fantastic musician, and so is Damien. But the thing Jack's got over nearly every other musician is an ability to be a really great player, but just to listen. Lots of really great musicians, technically great musicians, don't listen to other people. or they're just working out what they can do. And the answer is always, and I'm not the first person to say this, I'm not even in the first eight million, but it's always about what you leave out rather than what you put in. Always, absolutely always. It's never adding anything. It's always what you take out. And lots of really good musicians who spend a lot of time in their bedrooms practicing resent not showing the full extent of their flowering on every song or on every record. And he's really fantastic for that. Very, very lucky to have met the Daft Can.
Right. Feels like a tension between ego and id for a good drummer to understand.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, probably to fluctuating degrees, depending on the style of music. Like, I mean, Dave Lombardo, for example, you know, that's probably to the extreme on one of those particular indices. But yeah, it's so important. Like musicians who listen rather than just play is such a big thing, and re-listen as well. Like, you do something and you listen back to it, you go, right, what the fuck was that? Well, you might have heard me say this in an interview before or whatever, so I apologize for any repetition, but a big part of my writing process is to record pretty much everything, to delete a lot of shit as well, don't get me wrong, but what you want to get is you want to get your mind at the moment when you're creating, but before your conscious mind has made everything normal. So say, for example, like a vocal rhythm, like the way a song starts, your first idea is usually the best idea. But by the next time you're coming around playing, you've made it sound more conventional and you don't even realize you've done it yourself. Your conscious mind is fucked with what your subconscious mind came up with. And only by recording everything do you discover the magic of that first. Obviously, that first idea needs to be refined. And I'm usually only singing vowel sounds or something about a conspiracy theorist like David Icke. And that can't be every song, it turns out. It's really important to do that. And I think that, that particularly applies to music as opposed to other art forms, I think. I write as well, and you can't just fucking wing it. Have four beers and go, right, fucking this and this shit, you know, it doesn't
work. Yeah, it's a bit of a pet
project for me, that, like, forcing people to think about that, the left and right brain stuff. I find that nearly as interesting as the whole class debate in British music.
Yeah, I think we could learn something from that in the beer world, because, like, we might think of a thing that should taste good, but then we're immediately like, all right, well, where is it going to fit, and like, who's going to want it, and like, where does it, what is it like, and what is it not like, and what is it, how much is it, you know,
how, by the time we're having those considerations, how do we get it out there, you know,
like, by the time you're asking those questions, we've lost the point of what we're trying to do, which is create a thing that's delicious. Like,
yeah,
start there.
To a degree, you just do it, don't you? And then you see what happens, and then you fucking go from there. But you need to keep an audit trail to find out where the fuck it actually began. I mean, I don't know anything about the beer world apart from partaking in the beer, but yeah. So,
well, you're an integral part of the beer world by partaking. So.
Well, actually, I'm a part of the ecosystem, I suppose.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
So how long has the thing, the brewery been a thing? What, how long have you guys been doing it?
This is 10 years, I think.
Yeah, 10 years.
Yeah, I think Matt and I have been, well, I've been around for half of it, but you've been around for the other half of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a weird, wild world. We're owned by a couple of young brothers who came up in an entrepreneurial family. And we're just out there making the thing, and the guys who own it are also making it and involved in it, and often very involved in it, which is good and bad. And you know, Matt and I and a bunch of our colleagues, Dennis included, get to have an outsized impact in what it is that we make and how we talk about it. And we get to be like, we're going to talk to musicians and drink our beers sometimes and be like, that's part of our jobs now.
Yep. We wrote that into our job descriptions.
Well, that's, you know, that It could be a lot worse. You might have to talk to chartered accountants or something, you know.
That's true.
That you know, which reminds me, I definitely need to engage a tax specialist for my next
Oh, now that you've purchased a home, yes, you've got all sorts of different.
I have not purchased a
home. Okay, okay.
My wife purchased a home. In fact, the advisor she went to said, "No, don't put the self-employed musician on the mortgage. That'll just complicate things." So that's where my status is as a property owner. I'm not one.
You're a resider.
Yeah,
I'm got that door.
You probably help pay the bills, even if you're not on the.
Hey, I pay some bills. Yes. And I feed the cats, and I buy my daughter books, but I'm halfway between an owner and a renter.
I heard live-in babysitter.
I wouldn't say I'm comfortable with that, but it's where evidence has taken us. So, you know, I can't really argue with that too much.
Well, I was about to extend you a future invite to come back on our show, and you know,
I just ruined it.
Just ruined that. So,
you know what? Again, this is my coping face. I'm gonna be all right. I know my place in the world. You know, my place in the world is. It's like the emotional bends. We played Future the Left, what year would it have been? 2013 or 14. We played a show in Heaven, a venue called Heaven in London, which is best known for being a big gay club. You know, a club for gay people and gay music, as opposed to a club, which is totally gay. And really, really great venue. But 950 people or something, and it was one of the best nights of my life. Just incredible. Felt like I wouldn't go as quite as far as a triumph, but we're not a band who do loads of big shows, so most of our shows are, well, now it's bigger than it used to be, but we play what we'd say regionally 300 people maybe or something, which is a lot, but it's not a living level of, you know, whereas if we play a London or Melbourne, 800-900 people or something is, but so London, this show was fantastic. It was the biggest show I'd ever done in my life, but I had to leave. I was working for my council again in the housing department, and literally 7 hours after leaving stage, I was sat in a very small room photocopying for 8 hours. So I'd gone from being, you know, without being an arse about it, the main reason that everybody was there in this room, over 1,000 people all together in different, probably all together in terms of ticket sales, in terms of the money going into that night, 50,000 pounds changing hands that night. And the next day, 7 hours later, I'm in an office half as big as this room, photocopying things while a bunch of people come in and go, yeah, you do this as well. Just giving me the stuff and just being, you know, as a 30, at the time I was 36 year old man or something, just going, okay. And just the emotional bends of that kind of going from that justified kind of high to that very considered low. It's quite an astonishing thing, but I've come to terms with that all now. You know, I know where I am. I can go from we did an Australian tour just before COVID hit, which was just incredible. Like every night was like being a real band. And then came straight back home to COVID and looking after my daughter, you know, 5 days a week for 5 months. And I mean, it's still beautiful. Don't get me wrong, looking after my daughter, but it's not a position of importance. You'll know this when you actually become a dad. It's great, but you are now the lowest of the low. Like
down to go nothing, up.
I'm getting ready for it.
There is nothing beneath you. So embrace it.
I feel like that is the right message to leave this. There is nothing beneath any of us.
Perfect way to wrap this up.
Let it echo through the ages. Yeah. But listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
It has been a pleasure. Thanks for doing what you do. I really
enjoyed it.
If you do get to tour the States and you happen to be in the Boston area, you know, come to our brewery. We'll give you some free food and beer.
I think if we...
We serve pizza.
If we do tour the States, it would be... I mean, the guy I've been speaking to who's in New York, he has hookups in Philly and Chicago. I would just want to do Boston. Obviously, it's... If we do a tour in the short term, it'll almost certainly just be the Northeast, like right. I said, first and foremost. And frankly, since you guys are grouped so closely together up there, it makes sense to do all of those places. And even though I get confused to which one's further up, Boston or DC, it doesn't.
We're the further up one.
Oh, you guys, wow.
Oh yeah.
But I would obviously love to. So
well, we look forward to seeing you here. If we can be of any help, I'm sitting on a couch you can crash on. So
thank you.
You know.
Well, actually, my friend Matt has a place, like a holiday home thing that
sounds better than my couch.
Somewhere. But I'll be quite honest. Like touring the States is the rock band 101 thing. It's a wonderful experience driving across the Rocky Mountains, you know, just watching that endless scenery going past, putting up with, frankly, the shocking riders that you get in the States. I mean, it really is. You sold out this venue, 400 people. Wow, what did we get? They're like, well, there's your drink tickets. You can have a well fucking spirit. You're like, sake, can't even have a Jameson. What the fuck is going on? So yeah, great days. But yeah, pleasure to speak to you guys. If we can't organize a tour for next summer, then I suspect we won't ever be back unless we get a mystery benefactor. So if you hear of any mystery benefactors going around and they're not connected to Live Nation or the Koch brothers, then please put them my way.
We will definitely do that.
We'll do, Mr. Falco.
And take care of yourselves. And hey, don't fuck it up. All right.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Unless it's really funny. All right.